Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of Reading Orwell. This time, this is a conversation with a fellow Orwell scholar, David Dwan from the University of Oxford. We're talking about, in this episode, David's recent edition from 2021 of Animal Farm, Orwell's Animal Farm, for the Oxford World Classics series, which is a great edition full of incredibly helpful annotations and a wonderfully judged editorial introduction. So I highly recommend that you have a look at that edition of the text if you're interested to know more about Animal Farm. A little bit before that, a few years earlier, David published another, you know, very impressive book called Liberty, Equality and Humbug, Orwell's Political Ideals, which is another wonderful sort of response to Orwell's work and a fabulously nuanced overview of Orwell's political principles and the internal tensions that they possess. So this conversation is specifically about Animal Farm and David's experience of editing it, but it touches on many of the things that he's concerned with in his work more broadly, namely the history of political thought, the problems of sort of arriving as a literary writer at a coherent philosophical or political position, and much more. I hope you enjoy it. I began, as I often do with these interviews, by asking David how he first came into the orbit of Orwell as a writer.
Well, like most people, I suppose I read Orwell in my teenage years, and fairly predictably, I suppose I was particularly gripped by 1984, where it fed, I suppose, a certain interest in politics, along, I'd have to admit, a certain kind of quietism. So I think I read 1984 as a kind of allegory of the present, a confirmation that the system was corrupt, and confirmation that any revolution against it was foredoomed. I guess it's funny how much a moody teenager can identify with a varicose 45-year-old Winston Smith craving privacy and a girlfriend, and gripped by the idea that sex might bring down the entire system. I guess I also remember, you know, loving the thingy or visceral quality of Orwell's prose. You know, that bracing cabbage smell at the start, or the burning victory gin, and his fascination and disgust in the book for human bodies. You know, you remember the clot of hair that Winston extracts from the neighbor's pipe to Winston's own varicose ulcer. Now, I don't know if I'm reading this through the prism of middle age, but certainly those details seem to be as gripping as O'Brien's machinations or the inner workings of the party.
I've had a very similar experience of sort of coming to Orwell's prose through what he finds repulsive and what his characters recoil from. I really can't stop noticing it now that I have sort of hooked on to that. I think initially I had a very similar interest in Orwell to you. You know, I saw it as, yeah, confirmation that the world wasn't quite the way I thought it was, and that there might be something at work out there that's not working in my interest. But more recently, I've become really interested in these emphases of dirt and grime and filth and yuckiness, and sort of and also how there's different sort of political implications to that.
And it produces a wonderfully unsteady tone, you know, throughout the oeuvre, where there is this kind of extreme sense of solidarity with others and a hatred of human suffering. And if this doesn't sound too sentimental, a certain kind of love for humanity, but alongside complete disgust, misanthropy, repulsion. And I think that the brittle combination of those two things, you know, really gives Orwell his energy.
I like that word brittle, because it seems very pertinent to Animal Farm, which holds a lot of things in sort of tension. And I just wondered, when did you first read the book?
Oh, I think I read it when I was about 13. I remember being devastated by Boxer's fate. I hope this isn't too much of a plot spoiler. I'm imagining most people will have read the book. I read the book again at school, I remember, a few years later. And one of the things that struck me, and it has struck, you know, many others since, is the way Orwell's books, and particularly Animal Farm, was being used to vindicate a certain politics. My teacher was in absolutely no doubt, for instance, that the story exposed the untenability of communism. If I remember correctly, he said it was a system that made no allowances for the fact of human greed, or the pig that lurks within us all. I remember him saying, capitalism, boys, well, at least capitalism accommodates this moral vice and can even convert this vice into a public benefit, you know, a very Mandevillian account of how capitalism works. Now, I remember at the time finding that view all too kind of certain or self-satisfied, but it remains interesting to me today how Orwell's books can be so, you might say, easily drawn upon by his putative political opponents.
A lot of people have commented on this recently. I know Dorian Lynskey devotes quite a bit of space to this, doesn't he, in his book, The Ministry of Truth, to the availability of Orwell for, you know, for different parties of interest. Is that something that you feel that you've come to appreciate and register as part of growing with the book? Or do you think that that's only something that you can appreciate once you've had sort of, you know, life experience, if that's, I mean, maybe that's just putting the same point in a slightly different way. But it seems to me that the book, you know, a book like Animal Farm, which is so simple at one level, you know, it's so unfussily composed and is very powerful as a result of that, but nevertheless seems, as I say, and as you've said, you know, to be available to so many different people. Do you need to grow up with Orwell in order to really feel the both the possibility inherent in that and also the terror, almost the sort of vulnerability of Orwell's position because of the economy with which he tells his story?
It's a really interesting point about growing up with texts and coming back to texts. And I guess Orwell, you know, maybe every author benefits in a way from rereading. I mean, you can be lulled into bad confidence, I suppose, by the apparent simplicity of some of the writing, and you can feel that fuels a kind of simplicity of interpretation in a way where you know, have a certain line on what the story means when you first read it, and you're not necessarily encouraged or don't feel yourself compelled to revisit the interpretation that you've got. I guess that's the thing when I reread Orwell, I just probably it reflected different preoccupations that I brought to the rereading. But each time I was noticing much more tonal complexity within the writing, but I was also noticing much more political complexity, which I suppose some of my other research, which had tended to focus on the history of political thought, at least sensitized me to, or gave me a certain kind of set of tools for mapping things that felt kind of interestingly insecure in Orwell, not least, you know, notions like liberty or equality. These have huge moral force in Orwell's writing, but they're kind of fascinatingly ambiguous too. And you get to see that the more you return to the writing.
This seems to me to be one of the real achievements of your book, Liberty, Equality and Humbug, which is this most amazing tour through these very large, complex and, you know, ideas that you've just been speaking about, which are subject to very intense pressure in Orwell's work. And I was fascinated in thinking about that on the back of having read your monograph, to look at Animal Farm as a project of editing. So, you know, your recent edition of Animal Farm is, you know, the ideal test case for thinking about how certain principles are put under pressure at a narrative level. But I just wondered if you could speak a little bit about the process of editing the book, and then also how one handles this tonal these tonal fluctuations in the writing of a work that to many audiences and readers seems pretty simple. You know, it's sort of, it's a story about a revolution betrayed. So, you know, how did you find editing Animal Farm?
Well, I totally loved the editing, I'll have to say. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. The introduction stresses some of the tonal complexity, and maybe we can come back to that in a second. But in some respects, the editor's job when it comes to text like Animal Farm is refreshingly clear, because the text is written in historical circumstances that many people may no longer remember or possess. One obvious job is to recover that context and show how it energizes the text. One task, I suppose, was to show how Animal Farm operates as a critique of Stalinism and is animated by Orwell's alarm that Stalin's crimes are being played down in the face of some of his economic successes and by the fact that the USSR was a key ally in the war against Hitler. So I was drawing out the Soviet context a lot and annotating that quite a bit. And then, of course, I was interested in the way the story itself, I suppose, puts some of its own principles under pressure, most famously, Owen Major's dictum that all animals are equal. What does that really mean? This is a period when Stalin is criticizing equalitarianism and saying that it has absolutely nothing to do with Marxism, and is very alert to the fact that Marx criticized equality as a principle that would ground communism, and rehearses Marx's criticisms to justify his own seemingly inequitable distribution of goods and the centralization of power within the party. So the idea of what equality means is not simply an abstract philosophical issue. It's a burning issue in the 1930s, and it's a principle that's hotly contested under Stalinism. But it's interesting how beautifully simple a story like Animal Farm shows you just how complicated notions like that are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded here of a line from your book, from your monograph, Liberty, Equality, and Humbug, where you say that Animal Farm contains a series of concrete scenarios that stress certain kinds of situational complexity. And it's very much that, you know, the view here is that it's a sort of testing zone for these principles that the work puts under so much pressure. Why do you think Orwell found the beast fable form so helpful for that process?
It's a good question and a difficult one, because it's both extremely helpful and maybe it also begs the question against equality in interesting ways, the use of by enlisting the beast fable. So on one level, drawing the beast fable converts a particular story about, say, Soviet Russia and the fate of communism under Stalin into a more general issue and into a more general morality tale. And there are hazards in doing that. You might say ideological hazards, so the kind of historically contingent failings of a very specific application of communism, you might say, get converted into a more general story about the impossibility of communism per se, or the fragility of all kinds of revolution. So there is a tendency within the beast fable to that might remove the story from its historical moorings in a way and kind of create a kind of set of generalizations within the reader's mind about political processes, and the abstractness of the beast fable might facilitate that process. The beast fable, you know, is brilliantly enlisted. You find kind of human traits obviously distributed around the farm in the form of different creatures, but that kind of action puts pressure on Old Major's assertion that all animals are equal, because there is such an asymmetry of, say, intelligence, strength, and so forth on the farm, that you might wonder how could you claim there's any kind of veracity to the statement that all animals are equal when they're so vastly unequal within certain parameters. So already the beast fable kind of, you might say, troubles or complicates factual assertions that say all human beings are equal. You might say it even begs the question against equality by making the asymmetries of talent so huge. And this is one of the things that, of course, T.S. Eliot capitalized on and said that the story kind of implicitly suggests that the pigs should rule because they're clearly the most intelligent and the most competent figures in the farm. They simply needed to combine this intellectual superiority with more moral rectitude, I suppose. So the beast fable may beg the question against equality from the very outset, but it also kind of makes the case for the fact that these stubborn differences between human beings in terms of their talents, in terms of their abilities, their motivations, these won't necessarily go away in a communist society. This is a test for anyone trying to impose both a just and an efficient social model. How do you draw on these differences without exacerbating inequality? Becomes a key question the novella poses.
One of the things that this kind of consideration of a text like Animal Farm forces upon us is to think about the narrative point of view as well, and who exactly is telling the story. Because I often see in Orwell's work a very close focalizing on particular characters, to the extent that a lot of what's presented as sort of impersonal third person narration is in fact hewing very closely to particular characters. You know, a novel like Burmese Days really sticks very closely to the various characters that it tracks. And yet at the same time, you see points of view that are uttered and remarks that are made that draw on extremely prejudiced ways of thinking. And here I'm minded of Orwell's fondness for animal comparisons and sort of similes and equivalences that appears throughout the work, you know, throughout the oeuvre. It's everywhere in his writing. You know, 1984 is full of it. There's animals everywhere in 1984, if you know where to look for them. And I just wondered what this does to our sense of the beast fable and what you've been saying about the pressure it puts on ideas like equality, given that so much of Orwell's effort in sort of trying to draw attention to the plight of the oppressed, however variously construed, often draws on a language that is implicitly stigmatizing or hierarchical in relation to the animal comparisons that it invokes. So the short question to come out of that is, do you think that this testing is there everywhere in his work, or do you think that he's particularly alert to it in a work like Animal Farm and perhaps less alert to it elsewhere?
I mean, there are really several fascinating questions there. I mean, you mentioned focalization. I guess what makes Animal Farm distinctive in a way is that the book doesn't seem to be focalized through the perspective of one particular protagonist. You mentioned Burmese Days. We don't get things through the prism of a particular flurry or through the window of, say, Winston's consciousness or an equivalent figure like that on the farm. And that gives it a kind of, you might say, edgy neutrality. I suppose if it's focalized through anyone, it's through a collective, the voice of the animals or the non-pigs, you might say, gets prioritized. But it also participates to some extent in their slowness or their lack of mental agility. you know, the animals struggle to make sense of things like the disappearance of the animal, of the apples on the farm, and the narrative voice notices their reappearance amongst the pigs, but doesn't draw the moral inference that they've been stolen.
Sorry to butt in, but those moments when the narrative voice uses those sort of passive constructions, it was noticed that, it was observed that, you know, that to me was a really interesting formal maneuver on Orwell's part. And really, I mean, I reread the book quite recently for teaching purposes, and was struck actually by how unsettling those remarks are. You know, in when I was first reading the book as a student, as a GCSE student, it was just part of the storytelling to me then. But now I view it as the sign of something much more nefarious, sort of registered grammatically.
That's really interesting. Why do you find it nefarious? Just the way you can't attribute the source of this information, and this being bound up with the untraceability of power that, you know, is a real feature of Orwell's late texts.
Yeah. I mean, that's really well put, the untraceability of power. I think that's a perfect encapsulation of what I mean, actually, because it's, you know, for the first stretch of Animal Farm, I mean, I certainly feel as a reader that you kind of have a sense of where power is distributed. You know that, you know, putting it very reductively, man bad, animal good. And that seems to be okay and to hold for a while, with a few little insights into the sort of vulnerability and the fragility of that opposition. And one of the first moments for me where that really becomes evident, but in a way that is hidden behind some invisible screen, is that reference, you know, that first reference to, you know, it was noticed that. And it sort of shows you in the mere noticing, but inability to do anything other than notice, the position of powerlessness that the animals, other than the pigs on the farm, sort of occupy. And it's terrible, really. You know, it's just so sort of, difficult to contend with.
It also, I suppose, forces the reader into the more active role of being the tale sleuth and judge. So the narratorial aloofness arguably helps to create a more morally committed reader. Somebody that might actually take issue with the narrative voice at certain points as well. I mean, it's interesting. I invoke T.S. Eliot as somebody who, you know, endorses a kind of oligarchical structure within society, or he would interpret it as aristocratic, the most intelligent most rule. But the interesting thing is how the narrator himself, or themselves, seems to endorse this Eliot-like perspective, this idea of a natural aristocracy. It was natural that the pigs should take ownership or leadership of the farm. That's actually asserted by the narrative voice itself in a way that seems. Is this asking to be critiqued by the reader? Is it ventriloquizing the bad passivity of the non-pigs? Is it giving an implicit endorsement to what the pigs advocate? And are we getting a very porcine narrative voice at that point? So there's something kind of very, as you say, unmappable about the narrative voice, but it does slip in some very contentious judgments that the reader is not certain how to take.
I mean, I see a link here with 1984 in the sense that Orwell's interest in that sort of aloof narrative or narratorial presence sort of persists into 1984 and has different implications for how we understand it. You know, one of the famous examples of that is whether we read the presence of the appendix as passing judgment on the text that it supposedly acts as a coda to in some way, or, you know, and some people have said that it is sort of optimistic. Others have said that no, it's a totally separate thing. It doesn't have any bearing on the story. You know, the story ends negatively and sort of in a very doom-laden way. I wondered if you had any thoughts about there being any kind of progression or the relationship between Animal Farm and 1984? Because in some ways, I mean, I've always found the two books quite hard to teach separately in the sense that you can have the feeling sometimes that 1984 is sort of just doing what Animal Farm has already done more quickly and efficiently, even as it introduces other emphases that are not present in the novel, in the novella, sorry. I just wondered what your sense of the relationship between the two books is. Is there a dialogue between them? Is it a development? Are they part of the same idea or thought, but with different outputs? What do you make of that?
I guess there's an interesting difference maybe in emphasis between the two texts. Again, if you were to prioritize abstract concepts, one of the dominant themes of Animal Farm is the fate of equality in it. It is about the rise and fall of a noble ideal. I'm not sure I get the sense that 1984 is quite so preoccupied with equality as a principle, how it may be instantiated, how it may be undermined, the different versions of you get of it in, say, Animal Farm, equality before the law. How can you have equality before the law if different animals don't even understand the law? How can you have political equality when voting practices are so corrupt? How does the novella perhaps endorse a kind of Hobbesian cynicism that democracy is just an aristocracy of orators, given the way Snowball and Napoleon dominate the debates? Even democratic procedures seem to come in for a rough ride in the novel. And there is also the questions of equal distribution of goods. You know, how do you do that properly? Do you distribute goods on the basis of effort? Do you distribute goods on the basis of need? You see both of those principles not being sufficient. So equality as a practice, either as an economic concept, as a political concept, as a juridical concept, and even the concept of moral equality, what are the moral attributes that makes us equal? They're all up for grabs in this story in a way that I think is very interesting. My sense is that 1984 would be regarded more as a libertarian nightmare, and it leads with the notion of freedom much more overtly than Animal Farm does. Although both, as I say, combine in their indictment of, you might say, a particularly kind of centralized form of state control.
One of the contexts that is often invoked here is Orwell's Spanish Civil War experience and the insight into manipulation of fact, you know, propaganda and so forth that gave to him, aside from, you know, being injured in a very brutal way by a bullet. I wondered what, in your view, and thinking specifically about Animal Farm here, is the connection between that work and Orwell's time in Spain?
Well, I think one of the most obvious effects is the Spanish Civil War seemed to seal Orwell's opposition to communism, at least in its Stalinist form. I don't know if you'd take that view, Nathan. You know, he first tried to sign up for the communist-backed brigades, but was rejected by Harry Pollitt, the Secretary General of the British Communist Party. And so, as you know, he found himself fighting with PUM, an anarchist group with Trotskyite associations, though they were also quite critical of Trotsky. They were deeply critical of both Spanish and Russian communist policies. And this is the atmosphere that seems to influence Orwell's subsequent interpretation of communism. So worth stressing that at the time, Orwell seemed to have shared general misgivings about PUM. This was at the time of the Spanish Civil War, that they were hampering the war effort by not subscribing to a centralized command of the war effort. But it's clear that he bitterly resented their violent suppression. His own life was put at risk in that. And he was appalled by the kind of propaganda that was spread against them. So I guess two obvious things emerge from the Spanish encounter: is one, a revulsion, a moral revulsion at communism and what it's prepared to get up to. And it stokes, secondly, this deep sense that the principle of objective truth was disappearing from the world. And this was luridly manifest in the way PUM was talked about by both the liberal press and by communist press. And I think that feeds the kind of anti-Stalinist animus of Animal Farm. He'll refer to the novella as his little anti-Stalin book. Now, it's a much, much bigger book than that, but it's certainly anti-Stalinist.
One of the sort of interesting implications of how he writes about that group, but also the wider context in Spain, and how that leads to that famous closing paragraph in Homage to Catalonia, where he speaks of, you know, the deep sleep of England from that must be disturbed. That gives rise to, in Animal Farm at any rate, a book that really ends on a note of, I mean, it depends how you read it, I suppose, but it seems to end anyway on a note of not despair, but a sort of inevitable victory for those who are holding the reins of power at any one point. And Orwell comes back to that sort of circular narrative structure in pretty much everything fictional that he writes. I mean, certainly the novels. What does that seem to do for him as a novelist, that sort of circular structure? You know, we begin with Mr. Jones, and various things occur in Animal Farm that show steadily the alignment of the pigs with the humans. You know, from the fact that Napoleon wears an old hat of Mr. Jones's at one point, you know, they drink whiskey, you know, they increasingly, in addition to their political activity, take on human, they do human things, you know, they drink, they lie in bed, they have hangovers. And it ends more or less where it begins, pig and man being indistinguishable. Why do you think circularity had such an appeal for him, for Orwell?
It's a good and a difficult question. You're absolutely right that the circularity is a repeated narrative technique. Whether it means different things in different texts is hard to say. In Animal Farm, the circularity does seem to lend implicit endorsement to the type of pessimism that you see in Benjamin the Donkey, for instance, the figure who declares that life would go on as it had always gone on, that is, badly. And you feel that the plot of Animal Farm certainly lends sanction to this view in a way that one might strike one as odd or perverse if Orwell's broader writings are consulted about politics. He will repeatedly criticize pessimism as a reactionary attitude because it forfeits in advance any confidence in meaningful political change. And yet, it's hard to say that his own texts blow any such pessimism out of the water.
They continually seem to, in some ways, re-emphasize its likelihood. A text I'm particularly fond of is A Clergyman's Daughter, and that ends, again, where it begins, you know, with Dorothy, the main character, in her family home, seemingly returned to the domesticity that she wants to, or, well, some critics have read her as wanting to escape from, and maybe return to it in a way that sort of undermines her agency. You know, whichever way you read it, there's a sort of narrative question mark at the end of that book. It seems to me that the Animal Farm, perhaps there's a smaller question mark. I don't know if you agree.
The smaller question mark in what sense? That it.
So as to whether, so you mentioned a moment ago that circularity can be interpreted differently depending on which text you're thinking about. 1984 ends where it begins, with Winston firmly dominated by the party, and having, well, even in a worse situation, he's sort of been won over by them through torture. Animal Farm ends with the prospect of an accord, an equivalence between man and pig that seems to leave, as you say, the animals back where they were at the beginning under the yoke of a tyranny. In terms of pessimism, you know, you rightly say that Orwell is well able to criticize that idea, but one of his most famous works seems to cut against that questioning because it confirms the very thing that the animals so keenly want to avoid.
I guess what's interesting, I mean, yes, it does seem to lend itself to a particular kind of pessimism. I guess one could see these texts as cautionary or as warnings, and this is certainly how he saw 1984. I'm not sure you could enlist A Clergyman's Daughter into this sense of, oh, this is another tale of warning. Although maybe you could even see Dorothy and the glue pot at the end as an advertisement for the danger of being sucked into conditions of servitude, and kind of the stories kind of activate that republican principle that he repeatedly like to cite, which is, you know, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And he's very keen to kind of activate this vigilance by a set of dire warnings about how easily and how completely freedom may be lost. That may be one way of harmonizing the bleak conclusions of these stories with Orwell's own apparent principles. I suppose there might be another slightly more arcane and maybe less convincing way of doing it too. And this is to stress, you know, Orwell's anti-consequentialism. In other words, he isn't one of these people that thinks the end justifies the means, or that we should simply judge the goodness of an action simply in light of its consequences, that certain actions may be important to engage in spite of the consequences. And you might think that 1984 is a bleak story that, you know, involves a certain kind of tragedy, particularly with reference to the notion of equality. Whether you think, you know, that makes fighting for equality pointless is an interesting question. His point may be equality is good that you fight for irrespective of what happens. Maybe one of the things that Orwell is playing with, outcomes or ultimate results should not influence our assessment of things too much. And to dwell on the final moments of an Orwell text, you know, maybe a mistake. Maybe, you know, what we should spend more time emphasizing is, you know, the relative success of communism at the start of this novel. Certainly raises questions about the sustainability of communism. He also seems to suggest that it is a viable social model, at least for a period of time.
I mean, this gives me an opportunity to ask one more question, which is, to quote something that you remark about Animal Farm, you say it attests to the fragility of happiness as a public good. And I was just wondering if you think that Orwell believed that people could be truly happy in society.
You know, not an awful lot of us would turn to Orwell for advice about living happily, although he had interesting and slightly conflicting things to say about happiness, particularly as a public good. He seemed to argue in the middle of the Second World War, this was in December 1943, that happiness should be a goal of socialism. He professed that the end of socialism shouldn't be seen as happiness at all, that its end was brotherhood. And you might say it says a lot about Orwell that he sees brotherhood as potentially a very different thing than happiness. However, he's got other intriguing essays like Some Thoughts on the Common Toad, where he rounds on socialist killjoys who have issues with the very justice of happiness. Those who might kind of think that it's distasteful or vaguely obscene to pursue happiness in an unjust world, or feel that any happiness is a corrupt one given how poorly distributed or unevenly distributed happiness is as a resource. And Orwell is like, hold on here a minute. If socialism isn't about happiness, what is it? What is it about? And we kind of need some visceral sense of life's joys in order to sensitize us to a good world and the type of goodness that socialism wants to instantiate. He kind of seems to give at least two cheers for happiness in other tales. I guess a lot depends on what happiness is. Orwell is very keen that we don't kind of conflate happiness with simple hedonism or with a porcine set of pleasures, which is kind of mocked in Animal Farm. This hedonism is arguably satirized when Napoleon is deemed Lord of the Swill Bucket. That type of piggish Happiness is not something Orwell seems to have much truck with. Happiness is not reduced to pleasure, and it may involve lots of pain, and certainly, as far as Orwell is concerned, plenty of hard work. He's a guy who fetishized work as a kind of source of happiness and as something necessary for a good society. But I suppose there's a last feature in Orwell's thought that might kind of put limits on any sense of happiness that we might enjoy, at least on a public level. If you take, you might call it a classical notion of happiness, this would be a view that would say that happiness involves a harmonious balance of a range of different goods. And the happy life will include, a lot of these will involve a sense of equality, solidarity with others, you might say. It'll involve a sense of freedom and whatnot. But I think one of the things that I find really intriguing about Orwell is the way his work performs a kind of sense of conflict between different ends. And I think this is one of the limits on happiness and one of the limits of his own socialism. So, for instance, he thinks that socialism draws on liberty, equality, and solidarity. But his oeuvre repeatedly advertise how these ideals are in conflict with each other. So if you take just the simple question of liberty, Orwell often seems to be committed to a very kind of sharp-elbowed ideal of liberty as freedom from interference from others. And this is embodied in many of the utopian moments in the countryside where people cavort in relative solitude. They may enjoy, couples may be allowed, but any other social unit bigger than that seems to be abjured or slighted in these moments, because he celebrates liberty as non-interference from others. How do you square that with the emphasis on solidarity and brotherhood that you get, say, in at the start of Homage to Catalonia, that moment with the Italian militiaman, where you've this kind of very touching, almost homoerotic fascination with a militiaman who embodies the type of brotherhood that he sees in Spain writ large. I think these two principles, leave me alone to enjoy myself, and this emphasis on brotherhood, constantly trip each other up throughout Orwell's work. We talked at the very start of our conversation about his sense of solidarity with others, his hatred of injustice, and his sense of partisanship with the oppressed. But there is a really deep disgust at just the bodily presence of other human beings, their sweat, their ugliness, the way they protrude and connive against one's own space, one's own freedom. And I think that embodies on a very visceral level how broader principles are at war in Orwell, making any notions of a balanced life where all these wonderful goods come together and produce an optimal happiness seem naive or just impossible.
The Orwell that is known in many parts of our sort of collective culture as this great sage and prophet can sometimes seem sort of reducing of the complexity in his work to limit him to any particular point of view. And I think, you know, those examples to do with the bustling up of bodies against ideals and the tensions that they generate is just a perfect way of reminding us of how bracing it can be to read Orwell, to actually see these things being challenged, both by the viewpoints of the texts that don't seem to be conscious, so the sort of the narrative prejudice, we might call it, but also just the more conscious testing of principles, you know, and of which Animal Farm is such a great instance. This has been a wonderful conversation. That's all we've got time for. But thank you, David, for making the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for you making the time, Nathan. I really enjoyed the chat.